2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Taste of Chives Oboe Addy Legacy Project iBook launch and potluck on Friday, October 21st at noon at Oregon State University Valley Library in Corvallis. The interactive and multimedia iBook is a collaboration between the Oboe Addy Legacy Project and the OSU Oregon Multicultural Archives to showcase the history and current community outreach of the Oboe Addy Legacy Project. Again, that's the Taste of Chives Oboe Addy Legacy Project iBook launch and potluck on Friday, February 21st at noon at Oregon State University Valley Library, 3rd floor Willamette Room, 201 Southwest Waldo Place in Corvallis. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Stephouse Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Stephouse internet services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net.
This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is nonfiction writer and memoirist Brian Kastner. Born in Buffalo, New York in 1977, he is the author of the memoir, The Long Walk, a story of war and the life that follows. And most recently, All the Ways We Kill and Die, an elegy for a fallen comrade and the hunt for his killer, just published by Arcade. Welcome to Between the Covers, Brian.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about where you grew up and what it was like for you there.
So I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and I was a normal German Catholic kid, growing up in the suburbs. I think I had a pretty unremarkable childhood. The thing I knew most about living in Buffalo is that I wanted to leave Buffalo, and I wanted to escape. And in fact, my mother's side of the family was from Buffalo, had been in Buffalo for five or six generations. Everything revolved around the church, St. Anne's, which is down in the old German neighborhood on the east side of Buffalo. Big edifice that was, probably built by my Seitz and Albrecht, great-great-grandparents. And my grandfather was a firefighter in the city of Buffalo and helped save the church from a fire. Like, that was that church and that experience was the defining part of my childhood, at least in Buffalo. The other part, though, is the other side of my family was from Portland. It was my father's side. And so I grew up spending every summer in Portland and Seattle and
really
trying to climb Mount Hood and going to the Oregon coast and, going to Saturday Market and all these kind of things. So I have a great affection for the Pacific Northwest and for Portland in particular. And yeah, I mean, I knew I wanted to leave Buffalo. Leaving Buffalo was the reason I went to college where I did, why I got into the military, why I'd even thought about doing any of that. And then lo and behold, it's funny what happens as you get married and have kids. And we moved back to Buffalo because it is, I don't know, all that family history that I was escaping, I was drawn to it, and it is a great place to, I've got four boys, it's a great place to raise them.
So was there a sense of patriotism within your family?
Not exactly patriotism, or certainly, like, patriotism has almost become a dirty word in the last 15 years in some ways. I've thought that if I were an academic or a pundit or something, I would write a book called The New Patriotism and figure out, like, how to be patriotic again, and I'd probably sell a million copies. I don't know what the right answer is. But we weren't exactly patriotic, but there was a sense of, the point was the service, not even to the country, but to something more than you. So like I said, my father was planning to be a Jesuit. That Jesuit social justice influence was really huge on me. I went to Marquette University of Milwaukee, which is a Jesuit college. Like I said, my grandpa was a fireman. Like that, my parents were teachers. That's just how I grew up, is this idea that you're going to serve something. Now that's, when I went into the Air Force, it's because I wanted to be an astronaut.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
It had nothing. I thought that, I got good grades in school and nobody ever told me I couldn't. be an astronaut. So like that second grade dream, just it just survived and perpetuated all the way through college. Of course, I wear glasses. I can't really see. I only found out later that I wasn't going to be an astronaut. So it might not have been exactly that service, but I think maybe it was subconsciously. And then the more, once I was in the military and actually doing it, all of that Jesuit influence and service really coalesced for me.
So why electrical engineering at Marquette?
Because that seemed to be the best thing to be able to go into space. I asked my recruiter, you've probably never heard this before, my recruiter lied to me, like everybody else. And I said, I want to be an astronaut. What degree should I put in for? And he said, electrical engineering. And that's what I got. And so that's what I did.
There is that phrase in the contract, for the good of the service.
Right, right. And so instead, they sent me to be a civil engineer and then to teach people to wear their gas masks in case of chemical warfare. And then that led to the bomb squad, and that led to Iraq, and that led to writing books.
During your coming of age, were there books that were significant to you?
Yes, but I often think I'm the least well-read, at least in my current veteran writing community. I always feel like I'm playing catch up. So I was always a big reader, but I was never really very picky. I read lots of space operas and sci-fi and fantasy, and of course all the stuff in that you would normally read in high school. And I did honors English, but you know, a lot of my formal reading ended at a relatively early age. And then once 9/11 happened, I really read nothing but nonfiction and nothing but things about the war. I did read Catch-22 in Iraq, and that book will never make more sense than when you're actually in the middle of the war, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's something about the absurdity of living it and reading about it at the same time. Now, I can say that afterwards, as I'm playing catch up, now I'm reading things. I have to be careful because I read something, I read Kapuscinski, and I see how he does nonfiction, and then I'm writing a nonfiction book at the same time, and it gets sucked in, right? It just gets siphoned in almost immediately.
In your memoir, The Long Walk, you show that a person's war may be short, but the aftermath is both difficult and often long. You describe personally the crazies that you suffered. What were they, and how well did you deal with it?
I don't know how well I dealt with it. I mean, I wrote a book really to explain to myself what was happening to me. And I picked the word crazy, not out of some literary pretension or anything, but because I didn't have a better word. It was anxiety, but it was more than anxiety. And in fact, I purposely never used the word anxiety in the book because I didn't want to give the reader a shortcut like, oh, I know what that is, because it was that, but it was also depression, and it was also fear. It was fear of my own mortality. It was also grief where friends that had died. It was also a physical reaction where I thought I was having a heart attack and I was constantly in the VA. And they were probably panic attacks, right?
Exactly.
You know, but nobody at the VA could tell me that. So they hooked me up to the stress tests, and I, you know, ran on a treadmill, and they said, your heart is fine. Well, if my heart's fine, then what's actually wrong? I mean, that was a process. It wasn't that long ago, and yet the only thing I knew about PTSD back in 2008, 9, 10, is that if you had it, you were weak and broken and crazy. And there was still, I don't know how much of the stigma is gone. I think a lot more of the stigma is gone. Sure, certainly not all gone. But for me personally, I mean, when they first said you have PTSD, you know, I thought, well, I'm done for. You know, that
right.
this is the end of your career. This is the end of everything. This is the end of, I mean, I was out of the military at that point, but I was consigned to a life on the couch or something, you know, from then on. I mean, not to give away the end of The Long Walk, I don't have PTSD, which maybe says something. I think that says, you know, you can be plenty crazy, again, to use the colloquial term. And not have a specific diagnosis. I've learned just a whole lot more about, I don't know, mental health things in general and your own awareness of yourself. And a diagnosis just means you have a certain number of checkboxes in the DSM manual, you know, and that's about it.
Where were you on 9/11, and what was your visceral response?
Sure. So I think it's interesting that you asked that, because for this new book, I went back to 9/11 over and over again for so many of my characters, because it was such, it was not only was it resonant, where for most Americans it was like, where were you that day? But it was still the guiding force of their lives like 15 years later. And for me, it was the same thing. I was already in Saudi Arabia on 9/11. I was there for Operation Southern Watch, which most people have forgotten, but that was all the sorties we did over southern Iraq to keep Saddam Hussein from killing the Marsh Arabs and the Shiites down near the delta of the Tigris and Euphrates. And so I was there for, I thought I was going to be there for a boring tour. Nothing ever happens. It was more like Club Med, or, you know, it was a good chance to work out a lot and, you know, get in really good shape. And I had been there about 2 weeks, and then 9/11 happened. And obviously our tour went in a completely different direction from that. Actually, I think it was kind of funny, almost funny. Of course, we're many hours ahead in Saudi, right? So that morning, the morning of 9/11, Saddam Hussein's ground artillery had shot down a Predator. And so there was this big meeting of all officers on base. We lost a Predator today. This is going to be in the news. Obviously, we all forgot about the Predator pretty quickly.
You've done three tours in the Middle East, two running an EOD outfit. What was the most important lesson you learned there that you taught to others?
That I taught others?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I guess I have two answers. So being in charge of an explosive ordnance disposal unit, an EOD unit, it is all the camaraderie and elan and brotherhood and everything else, just like you read about, right? And my job afterwards, as a contractor, was training the nuts and bolts of how do you take apart bombs without getting yourself killed. That's really what I did for 4 years, 2007 to 2011, is just try to keep, there was a while there where every single soldier, Army soldier, bomb tech, before they went to Iraq and Afghanistan, I trained them.
Really?
So thousands over a couple of years. And we knew at the time, the team that I was on, as we were traveling the country doing this, we knew we were not teaching them the most important thing. And we would talk about it. And we would say, we're teaching them to use explosives and run robots and collect evidence and what to look for. But the thing they really need to know is what it's going to feel like when they get shot at. And how do we teach that? What's it going to, because so, what was the funny thing is, people were going back for tour after tour after tour, but in the Army anyway, they were constantly recruiting, and most of these Army EOD companies, 36 men and women, only six of them probably had gone before, and it was all the leadership. So we had all these new guys that were going to war. How do you teach them the feeling of it? And we didn't figure it out. I mean, I still don't really know the answer to that. But that's, What I tried as much as possible to impart that the technical aspects are really the least important part of it. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's one reason I write now, is I'm still trying to get the feeling of that right.
Right. Well, you described doing a post-blast examination while under fire. It's hard to realize how scary that is.
Right. And we can throw flashbangs at them, and we can yell at them over the radio. And, you know, the militaries have been trying to solve this problem for thousands of years, right? How to train soldiers, I use the term generically, before going to war. And, you know, some of the hardest parts of the day for us deployed in Iraq, it's not even doing the job, it's getting back and trying to like calm down before the next call comes in to go and do the next one. It's the in-between times. It's all the feeling of it that you can never duplicate.
You describe an explosion of an IED, and it reminds me of a volcanic blast with a sorting process of the debris. Would you read that portion for us, please?
First, there's usually a simple flash of light. Fireballs are mostly for movies. Then, after the detonation, there's always a cloud, sometimes deceptively light and gray, and sometimes oily and black. An explosion is nothing more than an instantaneous chemical reaction, and the cloud contains the toxic gases violently released. The cloud contains the vaporized bits of packaging that had surrounded the explosives. It contains the vaporized bits of whatever person or thing was unfortunate enough to be kissed up against the main charge. After the cloud comes the debris. Counterintuitively, the largest chunks are thrown the farthest, up and out, and so as the cloud hangs still a moment, the steel and clods of dirt and concrete and heads and hands and feet start falling on top of you. Frontal and overhead cover, the Army Field Manual warns, is needed to bunker against a blast. And after the debris comes the screaming. There is an audible pause between detonation and the cry of pain. The human body requires some brief but measurable time for the nervous system to send the correct signals from the body to the brain, to inform the cortex that a previously attached arm is now missing, a lung is filling with blood, bowels feel a breath of outside air for the first time.
Thanks for reading that, Brian. There's a point where you describe an EOD team discovering a weapons cache with video database, each of their names on the tapes, which showed how they approached a post-blast site. To me, that defines existential dread.
Yeah, it was like a nightmare or a fairy tale or a myth. Like, it's the worst possible Candyman, Bloody Mary, urban legend dream you could tell each other, right? This idea that not only do you have to worry about the bomb, the device, but somebody is watching you. And not only are they watching you, they're videotaping. And not only are they videotaping, but they're watching you like a football coach would game film to figure out exactly what you're doing wrong and where to place the device to target you. And the fact that they've identified you from your name tape on your body armor, your helmet. I talked about a couple of those kind of things in the book where sometimes these classified rumors, which is what we used to call them, or sometimes rument, like humint or sigint or something. There was rument. This classified rumor was as powerful as any other piece of intelligence we ever got. Another one was that there was a bounty on the head of every bomb tech. $25,000 for a kill. And I asked so many people, that was probably the number one. I asked so many fellow bomb techs, in interviewing the book, anybody I could think of. And nobody could prove it or disprove it, and everybody believed it. Because it's the kind of thing that, well, yeah, that makes sense. Exactly the kind of thing that would happen.
Becomes a rumant.
Right.
What were the strains on your marriage during your multiple deployments?
Yeah, it's very difficult on my wife, Jessie, and probably I'm only starting to figure out like all the strains. And there's for some people, the military life, it works for a family. The family gets into this rhythm, right? And it works for the spouse and it works for the military member. And that just wasn't the case for us. I'm fortunate to be married to a extremely intelligent, vivacious, opinionated, lovely woman who has, you know, and simply following along to wherever my career would go was just not, it didn't fit for us. Not to mention the time away, not to mention that it's not just time away, but it's, you know, it's time in a war. And that was one reason that's one of the things I wanted to talk about in the new book is I had, like you say, I'd gone three times myself, but when I was done, my buddies kept going back over mm-hmm. and over again. And when Matt Schwartz and his death is the, you know, the inciting incident of the new book, when he died, he was on his sixth tour. And so I wanted to tell a story of the military family and what those stresses are like. Like, I felt like that was necessary background to understand anything that's going to happen overseas.
There's a lot of talk right now by politicians about putting new boots on the ground. And though it's no requirement to be president or a politician, none of them has ever laced up boots, probably because they feel their lives too valuable to risk for their country. What do you think about more boots on the ground? More refugees or something else?
Yeah, I think I read something interesting today, and I'm gonna get the wrong reference, so I won't even try. But the basic idea was that the U.S. military can perpetuate the war in the Middle East, but we're unable to end the war in the Middle East. And I think that's exactly right. I don't know what the solution is. I just know that when we have boots on the ground for 15 years in Afghanistan and 7 years and then back again in Iraq, hasn't really solved much. And that's, I mean, my thinking has changed. I'll be the first to tell you, I supported the invasion of Afghanistan. I supported the invasion of Iraq. I believed in it when it was happening in the very beginning. I couldn't wait to go myself. We thought it was going to be a quick war and you should get there before it was done because you might miss it. And that's just, it sounds almost comical or sick or something to even say that now. So no, I don't think boots on the ground are the answer. Try to write non-politically, but since you're asking.
Yes, I'm asking.
No, I don't think so. And I've spent a lot of time thinking, I did a lot of research at one point about the Roosevelts. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was a Roosevelt that landed at D-Day. Mm-hmm. And he won the Medal of Honor.
Right, he did.
And there was, and you know, one of the most interesting people in American history that most people have never heard of, and died of a heart attack in France a couple months after that. And it used to be that our leading political and business families didn't just have skin in the game because of taxes. They had like if there was a Roosevelt in the White House, there was also a Roosevelt on the beach. And that doesn't exactly happen anymore.
As you've said before, Matthew Swartz was a great friend of yours. When you lost him, how did it change your life and what did you do because of it?
I guess I wrote a book.
That's one thing.
Yeah. So the way that the timeline on some of that is that I had my struggles coming home from Iraq and I wrote a book, The Long Walk, and it was all, we were all done with edits. In about December of 2011 or so is when I handed in my last edit, and the book was going to come out 6 months later, the next summer. And then the next month, January 5th, 2012, Matt died. And I was in this mode where things were happening to me and I was writing them down to make sense of them. I was coming right off a memoir and I didn't want to write another memoir, but I also needed to keep writing, I guess. And so we went to the funeral and I wrote about the funeral and I started to write about the military family, like I said, and I knew I wanted to write other people's stories because, you know, coming home from the war alive with all your fingers and toes and legs and everything, like that was enough. Like that was success. And then I did my couple tours and I took this left fork in the road where I got a book deal. And then my buddies took this other fork in the road where they deployed six times and then they came home in pieces. And the gulf between us was just, it was just growing too much. Like if living was enough, then having all this professional success on top of it was just, it was too much for me to handle. And my solution was to write about, well, to write about other people and write about the, you know, to go into nonfiction and spend as, you know, do the best possible job I could with that. And so that's why, the story of All the Ways We Kill and Die is slightly meandering to get to all these different experiences. But I felt like there were all these experiences that I wasn't seeing in other nonfiction. I was reading a lot of policy books and books by generals and books by journalists that were covering the Beltway. And I felt like I had mentioned already, like the what does it feel like? And that's what I try to focus on. What does it feel like to get your leg blown off? What does it feel like to choose to cut off your other leg? Mm-hmm. What does it actually feel like to fly a drone or to do an interrogation or these things? I wasn't seeing that. And so I was writing to, you know, again, make sense of it for myself.
There's a portion of the book where you describe the engineer, and I'd like you to read that for us if you would, Brian. And for those of you who may have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, author Brian Kastner, reading from his new book, All the Ways We Kill and Die.
Our composite image of the engineer is the amalgamation of very few men. Explosive device circuit designs are remarkably consistent. One main power supply, a trigger that actuates a transistor, a current dump to the blasting caps, a safety light, an arming timer. And so we can be sure that a relatively small number of mines have been producing many bombs over many years. One could argue that, like an invasive species, IEDs were introduced into the Levant and Mesopotamia by none other than T.E. Lawrence. His targets were the Turkish railroads that supplied Ottoman garrisons. No way for a train to find a new route to outflank such a mine. Al-Qaeda itself began as a movement of intellectuals, an outgrowth of the Afghan Arab movement founded by Abdullah Azzam, a Palestinian who received his Ph.D. at Al-Anzar University in Cairo, and the college educated Osama bin Laden. The CIA trained the Afghan Arabs in the 1980s in the use of remote firing devices. They weren't called IEDs then, at least not generally, and they spread from there. In the 1990s, veterans of Afghanistan taught the skills to Mujahideen fighting in Chechnya. Fewer IEDs were utilized in jihad in Bosnia and Kosovo, but that was purely practical. Yugoslavia was awash in conventional weapons, especially, and infamously, landmines. By 2000, Al-Qaeda remained an organization of the educated. The core leadership consisted of many former members of the Muslim Brotherhood, including the Egyptian intellectual and physician Ayman al-Zawahiri. The principal planner of the 9/11 attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, received a degree in mechanical engineering from North Carolina A&T State University in 1986. At least 13 of the 19 9/11 hijackers attended college, foreign engineering, and law programs. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria now consist of poor farmers planting IEDs and half-literate ISIS videographers filming beheadings, but they didn't start that way. It is no stretch, then, to say that the engineer is exactly that, college-educated with a real engineering degree. Many IEDs that initially appear simple are not. They require a relatively advanced knowledge of the inner workings of electronic components, signal filtering and rectifying, microprocessor programming, the breakdown voltage of specific transistors, how to maximize the gain of an op amp, that is beyond the scope of a household electrician or hobbyist. Such complexities do more than imply education. They also reveal how the engineer thinks, as we can decipher how he solved each engineering challenge. The choice to build a redundant system, multiple blasting caps and firing systems, ensures a device will function. Multiple countdown timers prevent an emplacer from accidentally detonating a device too early. Hand-drawn schematic diagrams of IED circuits have been discovered in weapons caches in Iraq and Afghanistan, and by analyzing them, we can even infer where he got his degree. Western universities teach that the symbol for electrical ground should be placed on the bottom of a sketch, while many Asian universities reverse that convention. In the early 2000s, just as the war was beginning, the cost of consumer electronics plummeted. Basic cell phones became so cheap as to be disposable. Many of these gadgets were perfect for IEDs, giving the engineer a convenient foundation from which to work. His ability to modify the devices told us even more about him. When one foreign brand of cordless telephone changed the layout on its base station's hugely complex internal circuit board, his wiring adaptation changed with it to a new physical location that was electrically the same point in the circuit he had used before. It was as if he had solved the Sunday crossword puzzle, and when someone else translated it to a new language and scrambled the verticals and horizontals, he resolved it to discover that 5 down was now 27 across, but yes, primer still fits.
Thanks for reading that, Brian. For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach. My guest today, author Brian Kastner. His most recent work, All the Ways We Kill and Die, has just been published by Arcade. Thanks so very much for dropping by this morning, Brian.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
And that was Jim Schumach's last interview for Between the Covers. We thank him for his many contributions to this program over the years.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2016 Portland Veg Fest, Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Portland Veg Fest celebrates plant-based living with food samples, experts, and authors to discuss topics in health, animal welfare, and compassion, chef demonstrations, and more. Again, that's the 2016 Portland Veg Fest, Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd at the Oregon Convention Center, Exhibit Hall A, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Space is the Place, showing Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. Space is the Place is an Afrofuturist science fiction classic film released in 1974. Sun Ra, space age prophet, philosopher and Afro-jazz bandleader, lands his spaceship in Oakland, expanding the cosmic consciousness of African Americans. Again, that's Space is the Place, Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of your homepage under Community Events. Thank you.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, SW Conser. And today we are live in the studio, and it's a packed house in here. Around the table, we have a number of celebrated authors and artists, all of whom are participating in a big event